Welcome to the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Peter Myers, author of Leonardo's Secret, a novel based on the life of Leonardo da Vinci, a man who seemingly needs no introduction, thanks to the world fame that comes from the beloved paintings such as the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, and the impressive collection of inventions found in his diaries. Thanks for joining us today, Peter.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
My first question is always, why does Da Vinci matter to us today?
Well, okay, why does he matter? Because Da Vinci was dealing with universal truths, I feel. And in other words, or universal questions, really. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? You know, why am I here? What is life? What life is all about? What is a common universal truth to all of us? These are questions that every single individual on this planet at one point or another, or even continuously, asks themselves.
That's wonderful. So does that mean you would place him, I mean, when we think of Da Vinci, we think of him as an artist, but that sounds like you were finding him to be more of a philosopher.
Yes, and it's interesting. He was a philosopher no matter what he did. I'll give you an example. There's a recurring motif in his paintings where he portrays someone with their finger pointing straight up. But sometimes the individual painted that way had their finger pointing sideways. But there was always a knowing, very evolved knowing expression in the eyes of who was pointing straight up, as if whoever it was pointing to another dimension of reality.
And you think that was Leonardo putting his philosophy inside his art?
Yes,
oh,
absolutely.
Beautiful. How fun.
And there's one painting he did when he was still in Verrocchio's studio. Verrocchio assigned him the task of painting an angel's face. And this angel's face was unbelievable. It stole the painting, if you could say, like an actor steals the movie,
right,
or steals the scene.
And he stole it from the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, he stole the painting, just that face. Huh? And it blew Verrocchio away to such an extent that Verrocchio announced to the studio, this face has a light that I've never seen in Florence. And you're now running the studio.
Wow.
You're going to be doing all the painting. Because what I realized from the face you've just painted, you know more about painting than I do.
Wow. What an amazing thing to hear from your teacher.
Yeah.
Wow.
And this stunned everybody in the studio. And Verrocchio said, now I can go back to what I really love, which is my goldsmithing and my sculpture. And that's what he did.
How interesting.
And that was a very telling beginning to Da Vinci's career as a painter. But the reason I bring it up is because this face was so ethereal. You can't escape the realization that this angel is spiritually way, way advanced from the guy on the street.
Oh, interesting. And that's what draws the eye in the painting and makes you really think about that other dimension.
Yeah, this spiritual light.
So now you're making me wonder, of course, how much work did you have to do understanding art history to understand his importance and those... Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Brilliant question. I did a lot because I studied a lot of art history in college at UC Santa Cruz. The first 2 years on Western civilization, we had two lecturers. One was just a standard historian named Hitchcock, who was an incredible lecturer, a real scholar, but he made it accessible to, you know, a student who just comes from anywhere in the country and
a freshman undergraduate,
you know. Hmm. And the other lecturer was a great, great individual named Mary Holmes, who came out of UCLA art department. And she just gave inspiring lectures. She was able to bring out all of the life and meaning from whatever she was lecturing about, whether it was ancient Egyptians or Masaccio in the Renaissance and his foreshortening of paintings, foreshortening of the human form, you know, where you have a three-dimensionality of a hand reaching out toward the viewer.
Right.
And you feel like the hand's really there, you know.
They must have certainly been wonderful teachers if you can remember that much about them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the guy who had, pardon me, the guy who had been the chairman of the art department, who was a sculptor also, named Gurdon Woods, he considered me the only sculptor worth anything on the campus.
Oh, he
told
beautiful.
That to the mother of my girlfriend.
Yeah. That made her happy that you were dating her.
I guess, yeah.
Oh, that's cute. But that's wonderful because that does address the concept I'm always looking for, which is what of your own background did you bring to the writing of the story, to the understanding of Da Vinci's life? So clearly this is part of it. Is there anything else from your background that really helped you understand him or find a way into writing about him?
My ability to research was, like, really good. from all the way from junior high on, I had a history teacher in junior high who every week, he would give us some kind of a question, a historical question that we had to answer, right?
Right.
And it always involved fairly extensive research. You know, we'd get the question on whatever day, and then I'd be off to I grew up in Pacific Palisades, and I'd go off to the Palisades Branch Library, part of the LA library system.
Right.
And I would have at it, just dig deep, right, looking for the answer to that question.
That's fascinating. That's a wonderful assignment.
Yeah. And it taught us how to research. And I never lost that.
And I imagine in the world of Da Vinci, there was such an amount of research to look at, you had to figure out how to pare down what you needed to know and what you wanted to cover, being that it's a historical novel.
Yeah, yeah. So in that case, I think I went through about 50 books.
Wow.
And probably a few hundred internet articles. And looked at a lot of his paintings on the internet, too, studying them. And that's where I realized, hey, this guy's always got somebody in the painting with his finger pointing straight up. And it was so wide. He must have been known in Florence at that time for doing this, because Raphael did a painting called The School of Athens. Mm-hmm. He took various characters in present-day Florence, the Florence of his time.
Correct, right.
And he painted them as particular philosophers.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah. And right in the center of the painting, in the premier power table, if you will, the power position in that painting, is he painted Socrates as a rendition of Da Vinci's face and figure, right? And he has him pointing straight up.
How funny.
If you look at that painting in the School of Athens, right in the center is the guy that is supposed to be Socrates with his finger pointing straight up.
What a compliment to Da Vinci, and what a remark about what he knows or what he was known for in his painting at the time.
Yeah.
And of course, he's among such a cadre of men, all of whom are still famous to this day, but none could know that he would be the one who came out on top, I guess, if you put it that way.
And the entertaining thing about it is he picked, like, politicians, friends, not just, like, the famous philosophers in ancient Greece or whatever, but he would pick a politician in the Florence of that time and put his face in there in the painting.
Oh, that's fun.
Somewhere in my research, I read a book where someone had identified all these guys. And it was just it was hilarious. Who was what?
Exactly, and what the choices. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. That's what's fun about studying and analyzing a painting to that depth. And you have to imagine what a painter went through in the preparation in the same way a writer goes through in preparing a book.
Yeah.
Did you think that along the way, because you had to go through so much material and you had to cull it down, did you find a particular theme or something that, what was your, the way that you found to give this particular story its movement? What was your focus in this story?
First of all, as soon as I started researching Da Vinci, I came across this standard cliche lie, which is We'll never understand Da Vinci. He was mysterious and enigmatic.
True. I've heard that forever.
Yeah. And this is 500 years of scholars parroting this same BS.
Right.
Okay. And here I come along, you know. First of all, I'm not a scholar. I had some comments at UC Santa Cruz that my work was scholarly. So the first thing I did was just research the hell out of it, or the hell out of Da Vinci.
Right.
And as I'm going through it, I'm seeing this cliche thing over and over and over. Oh, he's mysterious, he's enigmatic, we'll never understand him. And I'm going, nope, sorry, I'm not buying that. This guy was a human being. He lived on Earth. He painted. He had all these experiences, and he died, right? There's a way to understand him. Nobody that well-known could be so mysterious and enigmatic. I'm not buying that. So I kept digging and digging and digging and digging, and I came across a statement that Da Vinci made. The Medicis made me, and the Medicis destroyed me. Oh. Something like that.
Wow.
Right? And I'm going, huh, maybe that is a key into understanding him. And I started researching along those lines. And then I realized that Medici means two things. It means the Medici family, but it's also the same word for doctor.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's so ambivalent which he was meaning, because the Medicis didn't really help him a really great deal. He was never invited into the inner circle by Lorenzo de' Medici, you know, Lorenzo the Magnificent.
Right.
He was in that time.
Correct.
In Florence.
And they funded some of his work, exactly.
I don't even remember the details because it was so little. But Lorenzo was not a major patron of Da Vinci, although I'm sure Da Vinci wanted him to be. So I'm thinking, I can't even make sense out of that. So around the time that I'm contemplating going down that road and having trouble making sense with it, I came across something else in Da Vinci's notes, which blew my mind. He said in his notes, I want to write the soul, I want to paint the soul. And then, as if that weren't enough.
Exactly, a big goal in life.
This gets better. He, elsewhere in his notes, he said, there are many interesting things, but of all the interesting things, the most interesting thing is nothings. And he spelled nothings capital N-O-T-H-I-N-G-S. So he capitalized nothings. And I didn't have long to wait to read his definition of nothing, because in the next sentence, literally, he says, nothings stretches backward into time and stretches forward into the future. And I'm going, what the hell is he talking about, right? And then I correlate that with, I want to write the soul, I want to paint the soul. And I started picking up little snippets here and there in different books about what he was interested in. He was interested in the soul. I picked up that when he did his dissections in the hospital morgues, one of the things he was doing, he was dissecting bodies in order to understand skeletal structure, muscular structure, obviously.
Right.
Some of his anatomical drawings are still, to this day, used in medical textbooks. Can you believe that?
Another reason he matters to us, exactly.
Yeah.
But you're about to tell me what else he was looking for inside the human body.
So, in those dissections, thanks for keeping me on track. I appreciate that.
I'm fascinated with this concept. I've not thought about it before.
Okay, neither had I. In fact, I never knew much about Da Vinci to begin with. I knew he painted the Mona Lisa, as everybody else does, right?
Right.
But I had never delved into him. I don't even remember Mary Holmes in the university going into Da Vinci very deeply. Certainly, she never touched on this aspect, ever.
Right.
Right. At any rate, there he is in the hospital morgue, and he's dissecting the body, and he goes, I think I'm going to go into the brain now, right? And as he goes into the brain, he realizes that all the sensory nerves are going to a central point in the brain. The olfactory nerve, the auditory nerve, the optic nerve,
right?
The nerve ganglia or whatever for taste. All the senses have their nerves going to a central point. He goes, ah, fascinating. I think if I trace down where all these nerves are going, there's going to be the soul right in the middle of the brain.
Of course.
He saw them all kind of heading centrally, right? So he finishes his dissection, right? And he finds the central point where they're all going and no soul. Then he makes another logical progression from there, right? He says, okay, we all sense that there is a God. We all know there's a God. We all feel there's a God. But we can't taste God. We can't hear God. We can't smell God. We can't touch God. But somehow we know that there's a divine creator in this universe, right?
So how do we know that?
Then he goes, okay, now what about the human soul? And he goes, same problem. And there's a scene in the novel where he's rattling all this logical progression off to his assistant, who's trying to keep his dinner down, right? Because it's all these guts and all just bodies open up and everything. And this assistant finally couldn't take it anymore. He said, I don't want to go anymore with the hospital morgues with you. And Da Vinci didn't force him. But anyway, he says, okay, now what about the human soul? Well, we can't see the human soul just the way we can't see God, but we know he's there. We can't hear a soul. We can't touch, taste, smell a soul. But God is divine. Therefore, the human soul, i.e. man, is also divine. He makes this progression, right?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And he probably blows his own mind realizing this, right? He certainly blew his assistant's mind. But that's the conclusion he came to. And I don't know whether the notes were written before or after he had that realization. I never figured that out in the research. Somebody probably could if they did the same amount of research I did,
right,
and focused on that one point. But somewhere along the line, this all came together for him, and there was a certain period of his life where he was doing the, like, here's an example, St. John the Baptist. Predictably, he's got his staff with a cross,
right,
and then he's also pointing up. Right.
I'm going to have to look at all Da Vinci's pictures now and look for that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating thing to examine. There's kind of an ethereal or spiritual light in St. John's eyes in that St. John the Baptist painting. And he's looking right at you, and he's got kind of a half smile. It's not that far distant from Mona Lisa's smile. It's a very subtle smile, right? And I went through a lot of books, and there's one book I went through, and I think what was stated was, talking about Mona Lisa, she has swum in many oceans, was the phrase, right? And there was another thing in that book where he felt that Mona Lisa knew a lot that she wasn't saying.
Correct. I've heard that many times as the definition for what that look is on her face.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember watching a video of people watching Mona Lisa's, right? they're looking at the painting. And I'll never forget, this one guy's looking at the painting, and his expression in his eyes told me that he was looking at himself. He was looking into his own soul. This is why I think Mona Lisa has mystified people for hundreds of years.
I think that's true.
The secret.
We don't understand, exactly. Yeah. And maybe that is because we don't understand ourselves.
Exactly.
That's so,
like,
beautiful.
Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Where did I come from? You know, none of these questions are commonly answered by the random individual looking at the Mona Lisa painting or looking at Da Vinci's work.
but it allows us the chance to contemplate the moment and the quiet to have that thought that the real world and the chaos keeps us from.
For me, you know, the role of the artist in the society, stepping back from the novel and stepping back from Da Vinci, I think the best role of an artist in society is not so much to polemically force answers down people's throats, but to ask questions of the audience or the viewer, whoever's experiencing the painting, the film, the novel, you know, the sculpture, just to ask questions and to let the viewer or the audience come to their own conclusions, contribute something of themselves into the art. And I learned that when I was a sculptor. I mean, you got to realize, 500 years ago, he discovered the cause of heart disease. You know, in his dissections, he started seeing these people who he knew they died of heart attacks, and he found their arteries clogged.
And he just
put two and two together. Right. So there's a scene in the novel where the Pope is telling him, hey, you're desecrating bodies with these dissections. You're going to have to stop. This is unholy, right?
Right.
So I'm ordering you to stop. And when the Pope gives you an order to stop doing something, you better heed it or you're liable to get excommunicated, right? He was really trying to convince the Pope otherwise, right? And he said, look, I've even discovered what causes heart attacks. The arteries are plugged up, right? It didn't mean anything to the Pope.
So sad, because he literally proved how holy it was to do that work, because it would save lives.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Definitely a man before his time.
Hundreds of years before his time.
Do you think that ever frustrated him?
I think he was, when you see that self-portrait toward the end of his life, maybe it might have been 10 years before he died, 12 years before he died, something like that. He looks like a bitter, angry, frustrated old man in that self-portrait. It's a red chalk sketch.
Oh, I've seen that. I agree. You're right.
Yeah. And there's a scene where he's working on that in his studio, and his assistant comes in, Francesco Melzi, who was a friend. He was his favorite assistant, and he was a major inheritor of Da Vinci's estate when he died. Francesco was also a painter, and I've seen a couple of his paintings, and he was kind of a journeyman painter. He did workmanship like work, but it was not inspired, and it was not imbued with that whole spiritual essence the way Da Vinci's work was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, everyone can't follow that.
There's one favorite Da Vinci artwork that I have, which is not a painting. It's a drawing, and it's probably in pencil, maybe in chalk or charcoal, but it's definitely a drawing. And it's of a youth, I believe it's a youth, either a youth or a young woman, who has this ethereal, very spiritual, very ethereal look in her eyes and in her smile, and she's pointing sideways. And this is the most fascinating thing. You look at that and you go, what the hell is this person pointing at that's making her feel so evolved? Now, if anybody calls Da Vinci mysterious, that seems to be the most mysterious thing about him. What all these people are pointing at. Now, of course, the standard thing, oh, well, he's got to be pointing at heaven. But when you've got one person pointing sideways, no, sorry, Charlie, no no cigar for you. You know?
I love it.
Not heaven. It's something else.
Something else that he didn't leave any clues behind there.
Well, he left all those quotes from his notes that tell you, you know. But he really wanted to understand the soul, not just know that there was a soul, and not just know that man was divine. He wanted to really... Because part of his mantra was he wanted to understand and know everything in the world.
In one lifetime.
Yeah, in one lifetime, he wanted to encompass all knowledge possible. Indeed, I think he wanted to have an encyclopedia of all knowledge. Never got around to that.
But it's a beautiful goal.
Yeah. But he was searching for what he called ultimate truth, you know.
Wow. So tell me, because we're very interested in the concept of mentors, I've got two more questions. One is, who were Da Vinci's mentors and or who did he mentor? I imagine Mel Z falls into that, I don't know, but that's my first question.
Who were Da Vinci's mentors? I'm not convinced that he had any real mentors. Because of this factor in his life, he was a strong believer in knowledge through observation, not knowledge through book learning.
Acquisition.
Yeah.
Right. Interesting.
And he had no respect for all these so-called philosophers who were just studying what other people thought about something and were not going out into life and looking. And that was what he started, you know, at the age of 7, he was going out into life and looking in the forest, looking at everything. He was denied the standard, proper, conventional education because he was an illegitimate child of, what was that guy? Ser Piero da Vinci was his father. He was a notary public. He had a mistress, and he went through, I think, a couple wives. Da Vinci's mother was Caterina, which was his father's mistress. So he couldn't get educated properly, but I think his grandparents, definitely his grandparents took him under their wings and took care of him when Piero da Vinci was living in a wife's household or traveling, because he was in a town outside Florence, Vinci, and he had his clients, his notary public clients, in Florence. So he's constantly away doing the notary public stuff. So he got some education from his grandparents, and relatively early in life, I think he was studying Greek and Latin. But I never saw anything in his writings or in anything anybody wrote about him that I don't think he revered Aristotle. He didn't make an icon out of Aristotle or maybe Socrates, but he was familiar with these guys.
Of course.
But he was his own man, he had his own mind, and he wanted to observe life directly and gain knowledge that way. And I think he did a pretty good job of it.
No, I think it's a noble goal. That's something that we always try to teach students, really, that it's your job to go out and come up with your opinion and then be able to articulate how you feel about the world.
Exactly.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, so then the question has to be, who are your mentors in life?
I would say that I go in the spirit of Da Vinci with what I do. I tremendously respect the man. I would say the great fathers of our country, like Jefferson, John Adams, Thomas Paine, are definitely mentors. Screenwriters. There are some fantastic screenwriters. Now, there are other mentors in the field of literature, like Tolstoy, Joseph Conrad, Erich Maria Remarque, people that I refamiliarized myself with when I was embarking on the Da Vinci novel, because I realized, you know, what kind of style do I have as a novelist? How can I get style? What if I look at other people's style that I really respect and just try to understand it? The very interesting thing that I found is that the really great novelists, their style was so much based not on what they thought the public taste was or not on what they think would impress people, which is so much of modern fiction now. It was based on being honest and on being passionate and writing about what they were passionate about. And I realized after reading a bunch of great, really great novels, Arc of Triumph, War and Peace, you know, stuff like that, that the commonality between all these really incredible novelists was they were honest and they were passionate. And I felt so resolved about that I remember thinking to myself, it's not that complicated. All I have to do is just be honest and be passionate. You know?
That's the best advice for any writers, and we give it to them over and over again, and yet the assumption is to study what already exists as opposed to put out what it is that you're here to say.
Yeah. Yeah, because every person is unique. And I've given a lot of talks to screenwriters over the years, and I've done a lot of consulting for screenwriters over the years, like 200 or 300 screenwriters. I've consulted them on their screenplays. And I always tell them, if we're assembled in a group, that they don't have to worry about the competition. Because if they learn their craft and they write what they're truly passionate about, they're going to be individual. They'll be what my sculpture teacher in college called a personal statement, which is uniquely individual.
Exactly.
It stands out, rises above the crowd that's all just doing what they think is commercial, right? If they do those two things, passion and taking responsibility for your craft, there's not a single screenwriter on this planet that can compete with them.
I agree with that in terms of screenwriting, in terms of novels, and in terms of living your life, that you have to be true to who you are.
Yeah.
What do you hope that a younger person who reads this book, what will they come away with thinking?
Well, I hope in this is an extremely materialistic society. Americans in particular are more concerned about money than anything else. And it kind of irks me because there's so much more in life besides money. And I see really, for years, I've lived in some ritzy areas like Encino, and I grew up in the Palisades. And for years, I've seen really miserable-looking people driving Bentleys, Rolls Royces, Mercedes, Maybachs, you know, on and on and on, Lamborghinis, and they do not look happy. So it kind of gives you pause for thought. If they got all that money and they're buying all these fancy cars, why aren't they happy? You know, I think it's because modern man has been so imbued with materialism that he has moved away from what he is in essence, which is basically a soul or a spirit, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
He's moved away from his spiritual existence.
Center, right.
You know, and I've had friends from all over the world, and Latin America, and the Middle East, and I don't think any of them suffer from that malady.
So you would hope that someone coming away from the book is going to think about the spiritual side as
well? Yes. The ultimate conclusion I draw from it is if you get across the idea of immortality of the human spirit, you are actually striking a blow for world peace. Because what's the logic? How does a general in the army justify explaining to his, you know, the Third Army or the Fifth Army or the Sixth Army, thousands, you know, 20,000, 30,000 men, how does he explain to them the justification for murdering another 30,000 men on the other side among the enemy, right?
Right.
What's always been the justification? Oh, they're just animals. It doesn't matter if you kill them. I just really believe that man should be able to live together in peace, you know? And I think this furthers that idea.
That's a gorgeous, that's a beautiful place for me to say thank you so much for coming with us today and having this conversation.
Well, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure to explain all of this to you.
I look forward to people reading the book and having a chance to experience Da Vinci's life on their own. Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.